your story. New paradigms for a new world. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Monday mornings at 1 a.m. Streaming live at richarddugan.com. And podcasting on SoundCloud, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Stitcher, Spotify, Blueberry, Player FM, and a bunch of other places. And we thank you for listening. And we thank you for listening to the podcast. I highly recommend you go to the podcast because that's where you're going to hear. I don't want to plagiarize this gentleman who has since passed, but it's where you're going to hear the rest of Tell Me Your Story. How about that? It's not plagiarizing. I can say that. So we encourage you to go there, listen to the entire interview, sometimes much more than 50 minutes. And we also encourage you to click on the little grocery cart. It's in the SoundCloud player. When you're listening to an interview, because that's going to take you to our guest website where you can continue your evolutionary process. You can begin to transform your life through the process of what our guests have to share with you. And if you like what we're doing here, you want to be a part of it, hey, we're open to any and all contributions. We have a PayPal account, a Patreon account, both on the homepage, the radio shows page, and the missions page of richarddugan.com. So if you'd like to help us out, I thank you, thank you, thank you. If you have helped, if you have supported, and I thank you, thank you, thank you if you are going to support this program. I hope you all also support our guest who is coming up on the program here today. Her name is Lydia Finette, and I'm not even sure if this is the right word. I want to say an auctioneeress, but I don't think that's right. I think
it's just an auctioneer.
Just an auctioneer. Exactly. I thank you so much for joining us. You have a very interesting story to tell, as well as a very fascinating book. And ordinarily, I might say, well, I'm going to have to leave the room because this doesn't apply to me. The most powerful woman in the room, it's not me, it's you. The most powerful woman in the room is you. That is the title of her latest work. Basically, command an audience and sell your way to success. I've heard it said, Lydia, that regardless of what business you're in, what career or vocation you're in, and that can apply to women raising children. Thank you very much. That's a full-time job that ought to be paid a heck of a lot more than what teachers are paid these days, and they need to be paid a whole lot. We're always selling something.
Right.
And it's not necessarily a product or service necessarily. Sometimes it's an idea. It's a philosophy, if you will. This program is about new paradigms for a new world, giving people choices and knowledge of those choices, looking for those new ways of living. What is it? I'm going to put it in my vernacular here. So, Lydia Finette, what are you selling today?
Well, in the book, I'm selling a way to find confidence in your voice, in your vision. And I have had a very unique story. As you mentioned, I am an auctioneer for Christie's Auction House in New York City. The interesting thing about my job, however, I'm an auctioneer, but I'm not the person who sells art. I'm actually a charity auctioneer. So I get on stage at galas all around the world and encourage people to give money to nonprofits that they're passionate about, or they're attending a gala with a friend and they become passionate about it over the course of the meal. And my role is really to get up there and to inspire them and to motivate them to give more than they originally intended to give. And so the book is really about selling and the confidence that it takes. And I really learned it from being on stage for 16 years, taking auctions 70 to 100 nights a year in front of different audiences of all shapes and sizes, and really what that looks like and how confidence helps form that vision that helps bring people along to give money or to get what they want out of life.
And that's a big deal, especially for the nonprofits. But what about the people who are giving? Some people, and this is, I guess this is a nice way of putting this, and it's a good way of putting it, they're philanthropists, and that's what they do. That's what they take their massive wealth, if they, you know, massive or medium size or small wealth, whatever it is, and they have a heart for these nonprofits, for these different causes, maybe through a personal experience of their own. I myself, it's It's what I contribute to a nonprofit. It's a radio station in Phoenix, Arizona, that's a radio reading service for the blind and visually impaired, where I got my start in radio 40 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And so I give what I can, you know, and I'm hoping that as I become more successful and my decimal point moves further and further over to the left as the zero, or to the right, as the zeros are added on the left side, I hope to increase that contribution, because I believe in the format. I believe in not just the blind, visually impaired, and when I moved to Santa Barbara, they had the Blind and Dyslexic Center, and I hadn't connected those two. People have a right to information, and not to have somebody else tell them what they can or cannot read. For example, the most powerful woman in the room is you. Well, this isn't for men. Men don't read this because this is for women.
Well, no, that's not, actually, I will say, Richard, that is not true.
Well, my point is that's the whole point. It's not
just
for women, and that everybody should have the opportunity to pick this up. But let's talk about the focus in this case of your book. And it is geared, or at least it's talking about the most powerful woman in the room is you, in terms of, as you say, gaining this confidence. Talk to us about the concept.
So really the concept, more than anything, is about sales. And you alluded to this at the beginning of the podcast, that in life, it's not just a product that you're selling. At times it's a vision or an idea. And that's really what the book is talking about. And in many cases, I said the most powerful woman in the room is you, because I feel like women do not do a great job of selling themselves or their visions or their ideas, because they're constantly worried about what other people around them think about what they're doing. And I have two brothers. I have an older brother and a younger brother and a younger sister, a very strong father. And I've noticed this my whole life, that my brother seems so much more confident in what they're putting forward, whereas my sister and I tend to sort of always take the back seat in those conversations. And so in this book, I really went to the root of why I grew up like that. I grew up in Louisiana, in a place where we were definitely told, you know, your job is not to be loud. It is not to be the loudest voice in this room. And I realized that so many of these lessons that I've learned, having been from the South, are things that would actually really help me in my sales, because things that you learn about listening and taking that back seat can make you more powerful when you're in a room, because you're not the person who's the loudest, but a lot of times you're the person who's the most thoughtful. So I sort of divided the book into 13 chapters, and each of them addresses a different thing that I've seen, whether it be public speaking or, you know, dealing with rejection and not sort of shriveling, into a ball and crying, but rather confronting it and then moving forward through it. Selling authentically as yourself, because, you know, I have seen salespeople my entire life. I sell in my full-time job at Christie's, but then again, I sell on stage. And what I've noticed is that whenever you're in front of a crowd, we're talking about people who have great wealth. When I first started taking auctions, I would stand on stage and I would really talk to those people, because those were my bidders, right? So those were the people I needed to raise their paddle. But what I realized was that in a room of 500 people, realistically, the people who were going to pay the most for those lots were usually 10 or 12 people within the room. So that means there are another 490 people who aren't paying attention and are talking and are ignoring me and making a lot of noise. And so what I realized was that when I was in front of a crowd of people, in order to sell, I had to sell it to the whole crowd, and I had to make them feel part of it, even if they would never raise their paddle at any point during the auction. And at the end of an auction, there's a point called a paddle raise, where you're simply asking an audience to give money, not for, you know, a trip or a house or anything like that they're going to win in this auction, but rather just to give towards the cause. And I had seen so many of my male counterparts take the auction and sort of say, hey, Steve, I know how much you made last year. You should raise your paddle. And it was such an interesting thing to watch, because I would watch this gentleman, Steve, you know, let's call him Steve, sort of look at the guy uncomfortable. He would turn red. He would raise his paddle. He didn't feel good about it. Everyone kind of felt embarrassed. And, you know, it was sort of like the job was getting done, but no one enjoyed it. And so what I started saying to the audience was like, listen, I don't care if you're giving $25,000. I don't care if you're giving $1. What if every single person in this room got to raise their paddle? Because that's what it looks like when people come together to help an organization, not one person. It's a community of people. And when I started selling to the community and involving everyone in the room, then people stopped talking. They paid attention to the auction, And their energy actually made it so much fun for everyone in the room. And so I really talk about that, sort of bringing people along for your vision when you're selling. Remember, you're not selling to one person. You're selling a story and a vision, and that's what gets people involved, and that's what brings them along, whether it be a nonprofit or a product you're selling or even in yourself.
I know that a lot of people and organizations, nonprofits in this case, and of course here in Santa Barbara, we supposedly have the largest number of nonprofits per capita in the country. This is what I've heard. I've heard the number upwards of 2,000, which seems
wow.
pretty astounding to me that you'd have that many in this small area. But what do I know?
you know a lot, Richard.
The interesting thing is that some nonprofits, some individuals, some organizations have a devil of a time raising the necessary, whether it's capital, whether it's just funds in general to do what they want to do. And 9 times out of 10, it's because of the message. And I know that's a big deal these days. And actually, they don't use the word story. They love to use this word. I kind of like it. It doesn't sound the same. Tell me your narrative. That doesn't work for me as far as the name of the program. But
yeah.
the story that they're telling just isn't resonating with people. People aren't connecting with it. And they don't seem to understand that unless you come at it from a different perspective. And as you just described how you bring every person in the room who's in a seat, every seat that's filled, you bring them into the experience. Nobody's left out. You said
Right. Everybody
raise your paddle and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Is there a strategy for trying to or for rewriting one's story in order to get the point across? And a case in point, I mean, this is rather interesting. My favorite job. That if it were still available today, and it isn't, unfortunately, but if it were, I would quit this job and I would do that the rest of my life because I had so much fun with it. And are you ready for this? I was a paperboy in high school.
Oh, really? I love it.
For 4 or 5 years, I think 8th grade and then the 4 years of high school, I loved delivering papers. You had sort of your own hours and you met so many neat people. And I was lucky that I got to deliver to these two-story, three-story apartment complexes, you know, where I'd ride around the pool and toss the papers and so forth. And it was great. I just loved it. And that worked out great for me. And I was a top seller. I was going to Disneyland on a regular basis, winning this prize and that prize and the other. Here's the irony. I came to Santa Barbara in 2006. I went to work for a company called Bargain Network, which sold these booklets that had cars. They were selling these. It was kind of like Auto Trader, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you'd pay $29.95, and you'd get the it was incoming calls, thank goodness. And you'd get the call, and you'd prompt them, and you'd get them to give you your card number and all this good stuff, and boom, and off you go. I hated that job. I couldn't stand it. And I was talking to my dad once. And this is where the point goes. This is what my dad said to me when I said, God, I hate this job, Dad. And I'm so damn good at it. I'm making all kinds of great money, but I can't stand this job. And he says, Richard, don't worry about it. You could sell ice cubes to Eskimos. That's how much confidence my dad has in me as a salesman. But I don't see myself as that. Is that part of the problem that some of these organizations, as well as individuals like myself, have? Because we don't, A, see ourselves as salespersons or people, salespeople. And as such, we don't know what story to tell that's going to work, that's going to, and what's the right word here? Convince? Encourage?
Connect.
I'm sorry?
Connect.
Connect. Okay, I like that better.
I
like that better.
Yeah, I definitely think that is a huge part of the issue that people run into. You know, first of all, I think sales as a word is used very negatively. People always say, like, oh, that person's such a salesperson. Or, you know, I say in my book, there's a woman who had started a company after she sort of started raising, she had 3 children, and had started a company from her meeting room. And she overheard a friend saying, oh, you know, she's always peddling her wares. And she was so hurt by the comment because, you know, it seemed so negative. And I said to her, instead of thinking of it as a negative, why don't you embrace it? Because especially when it comes to you as a person, there is no one who will ever be able to tell anyone your strengths and weaknesses as well as you can. So when people are, you know, when I ever hear people say, well, that person's such a self-promoter, I'm like, but let's revisit that. When you say self-promoter, you're talking about somebody who knows their strengths and is trying to articulate those to you. So in my case, I would never tell you that I'm good at Microsoft Excel because I really hate spreadsheets. I hate sitting in front of my computer. These are not the gifts of a true salesperson, I like to say to my team. And I'm an ideas person. But, you know, I know that about myself at my age, and I feel comfortable in that role. And it's the same thing with sales. I mean, if you're good at sales and you can sell, you know, I think there's another one that you can sell ketchup to a woman wearing white gloves. That's another way of saying you're good at sales. Mm-hmm. If you have that gift, and you hear other people say it, you have to start embracing that and say it to other people. Because when those words come out of your mouth, that's when people around you start to believe what you are saying. I heard an amazing woman named Carla Harris speak. She works for Morgan Stanley. And she said something that stuck with me in such an incredible way. In her sort of catchphrase was, perception is the co-pilot of reality. But that means, I'm not great with catchphrases. I'm always sort of like, what does that even mean? And she said, I'm going to tell you a story. I was working at Morgan Stanley, very young, and I was sat outside of the CEO's office, and this guy came up to me, threw something on my desk, and was just sort of like, can you look at this? I'm going to go to see the CEO, you know, relatively soon, and I just want you to eyeball it. And she said, you know, the annoying thing to me was that I'm actually very detail-oriented, and given some time, I could actually have helped him with this proposal. And so she said the next time he came back to her, she said that exact thing. She said, you know what? I'm not going to look at this because you haven't given me enough time. If you'd given me a week, I could have done a really good job because I am very detail-oriented. She said a month later, a man came up to her, different man, put something on her desk. He's like, hey, Carla, listen, I know that you're very detail-oriented, so I wanted to make sure to put this on your desk with plenty of time so that you could get it back to me in time for me to present it to the CEO. And it struck me at that moment, what she said was so true. You put the words, what you believe of yourself, into someone else's mouth. And when people ask me why I wrote the title of the book, The Most Powerful Woman in the Room is You, I said because I wanted people to understand how I felt when I stand up on stage as that charity auctioneer. When I bang my gavel down and I start that auction, I feel so powerful and confident. And I want to make myself believe that that is who I am. And honestly, over the past year, that has become who I am because I put those words on a hot pink book and sold it all over America. And I feel like that is the missing piece, that we don't believe enough in ourselves to put ourselves out there. But when you do, it works and it comes back to you in such a major way, because if you believe it, then people around you will believe it too.
Okay, I've got an area I want to touch upon here, and I want to be sensitive in this regard. I have actually heard this said, especially to women in the workplace who are trying to get ahead, that they need to use whatever they need to use to move forward in whatever the business is. And, you know, if you've got it, flaunt it, so to speak, whether it's your physical attributes or your personality that basically gets men to kind of fall over and get the hell out of your way. And I'm not sure that that's a genuine and honest way to move forward in whatever endeavor that you're moving, that you're trying to move forward in. And to that, let's connect to that the concept here of the glass ceiling. What can you share with us in regards to and this kind of ties into also the Me Too movement and all of this that's going on in the country and if not around the world. And bear in mind, I was born and raised into a family of eight with four sisters and one brother.
God bless you.
So I have had a wonderful experience learning from and at times, yes, being corrected by any one of the five, including my mother. But I have a great deal of respect. As a matter of fact, as an operations manager for different stations over the 40 years I've been in this business, I would rather have hired women than men, because the guys, their egos got in the way a lot of times, and the women got what we were doing.
Yeah.
So talk to me about all of that. I realize there's a lot to unpack there, but begin where you will begin.
So, you know, as it pertains to the Me Too movement, I am in favor of anything that makes people feel like they have a voice, because I think that that is what the issue has been for so long, that women have not felt like they've had the voice. And then the conversations, you know, even what you just said about women using physical attributes or being told to use their physical attributes in work, you know, I feel like so many of us have heard things like that over the years. And because no one ever said it was bad or good, it was just something that was said, you almost didn't really understand where the line was, even though on the inside, you always knew where that line was. And so what I'm so happy about now is that the conversation is open and both sides are listening and there is change that is happening. And that, to me, is the most important thing. I think, you know, one thing that I talk about endlessly, you know, and we were talking about this as it pertains to siblings, I think that we also, just having grown up with guys in my life, girls in your life, you have a good understanding of relations with the opposite sex. And so I say with these conversations need to happen with both sexes. Women cannot have this conversation in a silo. Men cannot have this conversation in closed doors without women. Because what we need to do is broaden the conversation so that we don't get into situations where someone is telling a woman, oh, you should wear a tight-fitting dress to that. Because that is not what she should be doing at any point in her life. Putting herself in a position where she doesn't feel comfortable. Or frankly, putting herself in a situation where she is doing something that makes her feel uncomfortable in a role that's meant to be work. Or even, frankly, in life. So I think that the Me Too movement for me is a moment for us to have a conversation, and it seems like it's taking place, which is a really exciting thing in my opinion.
I know some people have said that it's the pendulum has swung too far. It's gone too far the other direction when it comes to the Me Too movement and so on and so forth. And I'm just sitting here thinking, well, you might think that, but what do you expect? We've had the patriarchal patriarchal system going on for thousands of years.
Yeah, yeah.
And but I look at the same thing. I say the same thing to people when you know people are, you know, they're all up in arms if we were to go into this arena here of religions, of philosophies, and saying, you know, oh, the Muslims are doing this. And I said, hey, the Catholics had their turn during the Inquisition. Okay. All right. So now it's this group. So it's, to me, okay, the guys have had their shot. So now, and I've also heard it said on this program, we've talked about this too, Lydia, and that is that women are not looking to take control over men.
No.
They're wanting to return the balance. Talk to us about that.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, you've hit the nail on the head, and I've heard it too. You know, the pendulum has swung too far. And I think in many ways it's true that the pendulum swung. And I think that at the beginning there were so many conversations that have been had out of anger. And so it's now we're getting to a place where people can have rational conversations, which is what we need to be doing. Because if people are coming with such anger, then no one's listening. Anger shuts people down. And so I think we're in a place now where these conversations are going to start happening in a much broader way, which is going to be so important for everybody to move forward. But they can't happen in a silo, and that really is the most important thing.
Right. And I think that key phrase is extremely important, regardless of what is happening, regardless of what subject you're talking about. If there's controversy and you're conversing, that's the key phrase, is at least it's started the conversation.
Exactly. Exactly. And again, I think, you know, taking away that anger piece is a huge thing, because, you know, and I say this to people all the time. It's like if you walk into a room and someone's screaming at someone, people almost immediately shut down. You know, they sort of only take their side and they refuse to listen to the person in front of them.
Yeah.
And the person who's listening is reacting in the same way. They're shutting the conversation down too because someone's screaming at them. So now that we're in a place where the pendulum is starting to move back, I think we're going to be hopefully taking these conversations and going to a place where we will see real change. And as you said, it's not about women overtaking men. I don't think that's ever been the philosophy. It's just, we're here, we deserve to be paid equally, we deserve to be noticed, and let's have this conversation and help us. Don't just don't shut the door and say, oh God, these women are out of control, or this isn't making any sense, or oh God, I'm scared, I don't know what to do. Talk to us.
Yeah.
Because we're here and we're open and we're ready for these conversations.
One of the things that I have observed in the male-dominated society in which I live, and I have to say that there was a period of time in my 20s and 30s, and by the way, I've had an opportunity with four sisters and a mother to have that insight. Well, you know, I've been divorced once, so there you go. one of the things that really frustrated me as I was going through the dating process, both before my first marriage and after, was how many wounded women I came across and how angry that made me that other men had done this to these women. And now I've got to pick up the pieces and I've got to clean up the mess that you left behind, you knucklehead. And there were times when I felt ashamed of being a man in this world because of what men have been doing to women for so long. And I finally got past that in one sense that I said, okay, well, but you haven't really done that. Yeah, you had your first divorce and life goes on, you know, and you did the best you could. And so did she. And now you're with your second wife. And I've made the commitment. This is my second and last wife. I'm not doing this. Not doing this again. I'm going to do everything in my power to stay together until we both depart this earthly coil, if you will. But I know that with the Me Too movement kicking up, there was a situation where, and I was in an interview with a woman about this subject, I said that there are men walking around scared to even look at a woman because of they're afraid that she may turn around and accuse them of something, right? Yeah. To which, with great attitude, the guest on the phone said, "Welcome to the club." And I thought, whoa, easy.
Interesting. But, you know, it's interesting because everybody brings their own perspective and insight into those conversations. You know, and I feel like the interesting thing about Me Too, and even in conversations I had with my brothers, and I have a ton of guy friends, my guy friends around when the Me Too movement really hit, it was interesting to hear from their perspective what they saw and what they were feeling and all of the things that they didn't understand. It was almost like they couldn't comprehend. And then on the flip side, trying to explain to them just, you know, what it's like to be in a situation where you are in a position at work where you know that someone is hitting on you and you don't know how to get out of it because you're 23 years old and you don't feel comfortable in that situation, but you know at the same time you don't want to enrage this person who's 40 years older because that can't be good for your career.
Right.
And it was very interesting because, you know, they were like, oh yeah, I mean, I guess I've seen that. And then I remember one guy saying, oh yeah, I remember there was a girl I was working with who said to me once, like, please don't leave me alone with this guy because I know that something's going to happen and I don't want to get fired. Mm. And he was just like, but until this moment right now, I never actually thought anything about that.
Yeah.
And I sort of laughed and I said, yeah, but that's the reality of working in a male-dominated industry and working with clients who, you know, expect something because you are sitting across from the table and you are a woman. And that expectation can be anything from go get a cup of coffee to, you know, being scared to be out alone at dinner with a group of clients and all the men leave and you're left with someone. And these are all things that I've heard my friends voice over the years. And we just never voiced them to our guy friends. And no one voiced them to the male colleagues. It was just sort of something that we continually swept under the rug as part of just, oh, well, this is boys will be boys. And I think the Me Too movement has really just shifted the conversation. But what does that mean, boys will be boys? And that's not okay. So how do we find a happy medium where guys now understand what is not okay as opposed to what we used to sweep under the rug and what they used to think was okay? And how do we move forward so that the next generation will not have these issues? And in 15 years, if they are at a dinner and some 20-year-old woman turns to her colleague and is like, I don't feel comfortable, but that guy will feel totally comfortable saying to the client, like, inappropriate behavior, as opposed to this business is more important to us than this 20-year-old woman.
Yeah. Very, very interesting conversation we're having here with Lydia Finette. And LydiaFinette.com is the website you can go to. That's LydiaFinette.com. The book is entitled The Most Powerful Woman in the Room Is You. Command an audience and sell your way to success. We're going to come back and talk more with Lydia here on the program as we continue this program. Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And we please ask you to stay with us because there's a lot more coming. Stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. We are talking, as I alluded to at the end of the last segment, with Lydia Finette. She's the author of The Most Powerful Woman in the Room Is You. And we've talked about that in terms of commanding an audience and selling your way to success. I guess that's one of the other aspects, too, that we might want to talk about, Lydia, and that is the concept of success, what that means to each individual. And it seems to me like each individual really has to find that out for themselves, because it doesn't necessarily mean a bunch of zeros before the decimal point.
Absolutely. It's a phrase that we hear all the time. You know, can you have it all? Or especially as a woman, can she have it all? Can she be a mom and work? And I say to so many people who ask that question, all looks different for every single person on this planet. So you have to figure out what your all is, and then your goal should be achieving your all and not what anyone else thinks.
Lydia Finette is the website, LydiaFinette.com, and that's LydiaFinette.com. When was it that you knew, and if this is the right way to put this, when you knew you not only were a salesperson, but that you had what it takes to, and again, in your mind, in your definition, you had what it takes, have what it takes to be a success, to be successful, and to have those attributes or what have you, accoutrement that go along with your concept of being successful?
I think for me, this has all really been a long time in coming, but writing this book and then promoting this book while also being a mom to three children and having a full-time job has really been sort of the penultimate for me. I feel like I've really hit my stride in a way that for the past 20 years in my career, in my life, I've always felt confident and good, but now I feel truly powerful. And it's a great feeling. You know, I say to people when they ask, you know, who is the most powerful woman in the room? Like, how do you become the most powerful woman in the room? And in the book, I have 30 case studies from different women, everyone from Martha Stewart to a friend of mine who became a silver medalist in the Olympics to a friend who started a baby food company. So really women sort of in all industries at all levels of success. And I asked them just to sort of contribute their ideas about what they thought about certain chapters in the book. And the interesting thing was some of the women I didn't know, some had been passed along from other friends. And the women who, without any doubt, are power women, women like Martha Stewart or Barbara Corcoran or Deborah Roberts, when I asked them to be in the book, none of them asked me who else was in the book. It was the people that I actually had never heard of and that I was sort of asking because a friend had given me their information. They were the people who asked me who else was going to be included in the case studies in the book. And I realized that actually power comes from not really caring about what other people think or their perception of you. It comes from within. And you know, Martha Stewart doesn't have to ask anyone if she can be in the most powerful woman in the room as you because she already believes that she is. The same with Barbara Corcoran, the same with Nina Garcia, these sort of incredible women who've made it to the top of their career. And that realization to me was so stark because, you know, here I had Martha Stewart saying, yeah, of course, I'll do whatever you want. I can put a blurb on the back of your book. I'll do a case study in the book. And then I had a woman I had never heard of being like, well, I don't know. Who else is in the book? Who else? You know, what did they say? Or, you know, sort of asking all these questions so that she could inform herself so that she too could feel powerful. And I was like, aha, I've got it. I understand what power really is. It's all within.
Now, I had an interesting experience, and of course, in this case, it was with some gentlemen. They were businessmen from Mexico, and I don't know if they were born in Mexico or if they were first generation or what have you, but they did a regular overnight Spanish music program on a Christian station I worked for back in the 80s and 90s. And one of my coworkers, in this case a female, who I mistakenly thought was from Mexico, and boy, did she let me know she wasn't, because she was very proud of her Spanish heritage and that there was a big difference, right? Well, anyway, these gentlemen would come in, and they would want to do this, that, and the other thing to prepare for their program, which obviously they had the right to do. But I was observing, my observation was, God, these guys are arrogant. God, they just think that they're so full of themselves. And they would come in beautiful suits. I mean, just gorgeous suits, right? And I started talking with her. Her name was Carmen. I said, I don't get it. These guys are so arrogant. These guys are so this, that, and the other thing. And she says, and she stopped me. She says, no, that is not arrogance. That is confidence.
Yeah. It's true. That is confidence.
Now, how does one, because I myself do everything I can to stay as humble as possible, and I am thankful that the universe helps me there, because every time I get just a little too big for my britches, the universe has this way of giving me my comeuppance and saying, calm down, young man. Yes, you're good at what you do, but there's always someone above you as well as below you. And if you keep that in mind, you'll keep a level head and you will really enjoy your life. And thank goodness I haven't had too many of those. But but nonetheless, I have thousands of people to thank. You know, if I was getting an award, I'd like to thank the Academy, and you can't play me off with the music because I've got too many people to list who have helped me get where I am. I did not get here on my own. No. But talk to us about the difference between, and how you can maybe see that in someone, the difference between that confidence versus that arrogance, and for that matter, even that narcissistic self-importance that people come across with.
So in the book, I talk a lot about this topic because I feel so strongly that a leader who is a good leader is a leader who becomes a leader surrounded by people who raise that person up and who in exchange, not in a way that is bad, but as part of that leadership, is constantly lifting people up around him or her as well. You know, I say to my team all the time, like, what's the point in being a leader if you've done it by stepping on everyone else's head on the way up? Because the minute something goes wrong, you have a target on your back, and you will be the first one taken down. If you are a leader who comes up bringing other people with you, then you will have their love and their loyalty. And when something goes wrong, they'll form a wall around you and make sure that you are protected at all times. And I think that that really is about confidence. Confidence comes from helping other people and inspiring other people. And confidence is infectious. People who don't feel confident see someone who's confident and some envy, but as long as your hands are outstretched and you're willing to help them, they become part of your confidence build over time. So, yeah, I mean, there's certainly people who are narcissistic. I run into them. I live in New York City. This is a city filled with narcissistic people. But I truly believe, you know, I remember having a conversation with a woman who was on my team, who I think had always worked for people who were constantly trying to put her down or stealing her ideas because she's incredibly, incredibly smart. And I remember we were talking about something and she kept getting sort of angrier and angrier. And I looked across the table and I said, do you know that I want you to succeed? I am your biggest cheerleader. I am only here to help you. I'm not here to take your ideas. I will give you credit for everything you've done because I'm confident in myself and I don't believe that I need to take your ideas to prove that I'm good at my job. Like that is a sign of an insecure person. If you are secure in yourself, you believe in your ideas and you're fine letting other people shine because they don't outshine you. They just become part of your glow.
I've taken the perspective, I'd like you to address this. I take the perspective when I'm working with anybody, whether it's someone I'm training or a client, an advertiser, a programmer, whoever it is, and my objective isn't to be successful. My objective is to make that person successful.
Yeah.
And then in turn, I become successful. But my intent is not for me to become successful, even though it kind of sounds a little self-serving. But be that as it may, talk to us about taking on that mantle or that attitude.
I definitely believe that that's true. And my dad has been such a great example of that in my life. I mean, my father would give you the shirt off of his back. He was an attorney, or he just retired recently, but he literally helps people for absolutely no reason. He makes connections for people for no reason other than to connect them. He's like, look, I'm paying it forward. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people will be like, but you're spending so much time on this. He's like, who cares? At the end of the day, if that person succeeds, then it's worth it. And that's such a great way to live life, because if you're not expecting anything, I sometimes feel like it comes back tenfold. You know, when the book came out, I can't tell you how many people I've encountered along the way, old interns, people who worked on my teams, people that I've worked with on projects, reached out and said, you know, can I do a book party for you? Can I buy a book and can you sign it for my mom? Just like these sort of simple acts of kindness. And I think in a situation like that, you suddenly realize that you have done right by people over the course of your life, because they're willing to help without you asking. And I think that's when you know that you're living a real, true life of service to others, which I think is really where confidence comes from, because you feel good about the life that you're living.
And you don't wait for others to do that either, do you?
Yeah.
I'm I get so frustrated when I talk with people about or I hear radio or TV programs where there are people who are saying, oh, now climate change, the science is flawed. It's just a manipulation. It's a conspiracy, blah, blah, blah. And I'm sitting here thinking, all right, toss it out. We should be cleaning up our homes. I mean, don't you? Every weekend, we vacuum the floors, we go through and we finish up the laundry, and if there are dishes, we do those. Da, da. Why would you do that? Well, because we like to have a clean place. Well, then why shouldn't we do the same thing for the planet? Well, but none of the other countries are doing their part, they will say. And I'm sitting here thinking, so what?
Yeah.
So what?
Stop if your neighbors, right.
Yeah, if your neighbors stop trimming their lawn and cutting the grass and cleaning their house and all of that, you would you know, do the same, you know,
yep.
Just let it go.
Absolutely. Let it go. Absolutely.
You know, it's just I've never understood that mentality that wait for others. You actually, what is it? The saying about doing the right thing. If there was you have integrity if you were to do the right thing and nobody was watching.
Right. Exactly.
What about that in the corporate world? Because, I mean, you and I both know that the general public is not real happy with corporate America, let alone government America, because of the way in which they behave and the way in which, after a period of time, certain things come out and they wind up in court and they'll settle, but they won't take responsibility for the reasons why they're settling. And I'm going, that makes no sense to me at all. Because if you're paying, then you're guilty. If you weren't guilty, you would have gone to trial and proved your case. And so I just find that whole thing a little bizarre. But talk to us about that element of our society that we have to work through as individuals who want to be successful and who want to do things and do right by people.
Well, I think the greatest thing that we see in this day and age is the people who rise up naturally because of the fact that they are doing right by people. And I feel like we're in such an interesting and not necessarily a positive time in our world. And I'm always curious as to who rises to the top in these situations, and then watching their trajectory and seeing what they're going to do when they hit the top. Like, do they go the way of the people that we've seen come before them who do exactly what you've said? Because I feel like especially the millennial generation is watching more closely than the past generations have, certainly. They're watching and there's accountability. And I think that accountability, hopefully, is going to be something that we're going to see in all of our leaders, because at some point, something has to give. Otherwise, everything's just going to implode the way that it is. And I truly believe that if we keep holding people accountable as a nation, as a world, we will eventually get to a place where the best and the brightest are at the top. And it's not just sort of whomever is up for grabbing the spotlight at that moment.
Yeah, and I'm curious, because this is not exclusively part of the men's club, that there are women who are also, or who can become just as ruthless. I mean, you know, I look at television, and yes, a lot of it is fiction, but at the same time, especially when I look at science fiction, it's like, okay, if they're depicting that in this science fiction program, odds are this technology probably already exists in some fashion.
Yeah.
You know, case in point, Jules Verne's in Flight to the Moon. So what about that in terms of women being taken in by this, and I can't think of any other word to use, this corruptive or corrosive mentality?
I mean, I think my advice is it always goes back to power and really trying to find the power within and to block out the white noise around you and focus on what you can change and what you can help. And that's what I would encourage of anyone, man or woman, in any field and any success, in sort of any level of success. Because honestly, as long as we keep looking around, pointing fingers at other people not doing the right thing without doing the right thing ourselves, that's when none of it makes sense for anyone. Because unless you are showing leadership and showing the ability to make change by making those changes yourself, then your entire argument is completely null and void.
Yeah, it's and for some folks, it's, I don't know why it's so hard. It's like, I don't think about this. You know, I talk to people about, for example, the laws that we have on our books about certain things that we don't do. You know, thou shalt not kill. Well, we have laws against murder. But
right.
From my perspective, where I am right now talking with you, Lydia Finette, the laws regarding taking of another human life are irrelevant to me because that's not where my head's at.
Right.
And I hope it's never there.
Yeah,
I mean, I tell people, I say, look, when I'm driving in my truck, if I hit another human being, you know, by accident, okay, with my truck, I'm going to stop the truck, turn it off, take the keys out, and when the police arrive, I'm giving them my driver's license because I just used because this massive machine that I'm driving, and I wasn't in total control, obviously, because I hit another human being and changed their life and mine forever.
Yeah.
And that's not the way I want to change lives.
Right.
What are the steps that you encourage people to follow, women in this case, as your book says, the most powerful woman in the room. I keep wanting to say in the world. In the room. Is
not
you.
The only one. I've definitely been introduced as the book the most powerful woman in the world before. Really, it's very impactful.
Hey,
certainly.
Think big. Think big, Lydia. Come on, think big.
Next book.
Yeah,
next
right.
Book.
But where does one start? Where would you suggest that a woman would start who's listening to this saying, I really wish I had more confidence and I would really like to succeed at doing this and that, that, that. And I have these dreams of, but I'm getting so much flack from outside of myself. Bop, 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 bop. Where do I start, Lydia?
I would say start by looking around at the people you're surrounding yourself with. Because if that's the way that you're feeling day in and day out, then the chances are that you don't have the right people around you. Because if you are literally ingrained in a number of people who choose to live their lives and be excited about life, then you are going to be with the right people. And so I would say, number one, surround yourself with the right people who are living a positive, inspired life. Because that's, as I said earlier, confidence is infectious. So I would start there. And then I would also start to, as I said earlier, as it pertains to the message of this book, write down who you want to be and start telling people who you want to be. I want to be the most powerful woman in the room. All right, start telling people that. And literally tell every single person you know, oh, I'm doing this, I have this project, I feel great about it, it's going to be really strong, it's going to be really confident, or I want to be the head of the PTA, I want to be the president of the PTA, this is how I'm going to get there, this is how I'm going to make it happen. In one of the chapters, I talk about road mapping your way to success, sort of sitting down with a pencil and paper and figuring out your goals and not letting other people tell you what you should want or what you should be doing, which is, I think, something that we often fall into, sort of thinking that other people can figure out our dreams for us, figure out our goals. And as we also talked about earlier, everyone's goals are different. So what do yours look like? Get yourself laser focused and then start talking to the people you've now surrounded yourself with about how you're going to reach those goals. Because confidence comes from checking things off a list as you go along.
You know, I want to do this. Check. I did it. Look at that. I followed through on something. Here we go. Next thing. So I would highly encourage women or men who are listening to start with those sort of two simple tips. Assess the people around you. Make sure that you're surrounding yourself with positive, impactful people. And then sit down and write what you want out of your life. Don't just sort of float on the tide like a jellyfish. Get in there, get deep and figure it out and start going for it in a big way.
Hmm. How about those men and women, or I should say women and men, who don't know what it is that they want to do because they have been, they don't have, let's just say they don't have the education that has opened the doors of opportunity to new choices that they've never even thought of before. You know, and we've got them because we have people who are, and I will put it this way, they are part of the generational entitlement society through no fault of their own, quite honestly, because their parents and their parents before them, maybe going back to the 60s or early 70s, what have you. It's all they knew. They never had the education to get out of that pattern. And so they pass that pattern on to their kids who don't get the education that they so richly deserve to create the new ideas in their own minds to move forward. And you know how parents always say, I just want a better life for my kids. And you keep hearing that from each generation. I just want better right. life for my kids. I want them to have more than I did kind of stuff. What about yep. what about those situations where someone just hasn't, they just haven't found that yet?
It's okay. I say when in the chapter I write about the roadmap, write it in pencil because you never know what's going to come along the way. Like my roadmap has changed endless times over the years. And I didn't even really know, like for instance, writing a book. I started talking about writing a book 6 years before I put any paper to pen to paper, like literally talked about it to everyone, did nothing about it. And it wasn't until I sort of forced my own hand by mentioning it to a reporter who then printed it on paper. And I saw it and was like, I have to do this. I have to get it done.
Oh, now you're
but
stuck.
Actually, yeah, literally went into the New York Times. I mean, I didn't have a choice. All of a sudden, everyone's like, so when is this book coming out? I'm like, right, the book. Yes, I'm going to do that now because I've just said it out loud and now I'm in real trouble. But I would say, you know, to your listeners, just start writing because honestly, somewhere deep down inside, even if you don't know what it is, you will figure it out. And it doesn't have to be today. It doesn't have to be tomorrow. But start the process of trying to figure it out, like what that looks like for you. And look, it could literally be like make it through 2 weeks with like, you know, getting my groceries, getting my kids to school on time and doing something. It could be a short roadmap all the way to, as I said earlier, I want to be the president of the PTA. I want to make sure that I hit that meeting 5 times a year, or I want to be the CEO of a company, or you know what, I used to be an artist and I want to start drawing again. All of those things are dreams that we have. They don't have to be CEO of the company dreams. They can be just a dream that's in the back of your head that you haven't done in a long time because you kind of forgot about it. And that's what I think brings passion from life. It's sort of opening yourself up to opportunities in every way, shape, or form. And as it pertains to education, I mean, the internet is the internet. People have access to everything now. So know that you can go to your local library and get online and learn, or you can go to your local library and pick up a book and learn. And just never stop learning because that's such an important part of life.
I just read something here. I want to tie into this. And it may not seem to some like, but this is one of those implacable walls of sorts that we don't really think too much about. And it says here that according to the World Health Organization, the United States is the most anxious nation on earth, with at least 1 in 5 people, a full 40 million Americans currently diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. According to a new APA poll, reveals that for the second year in a row, 2 in every 3 Americans says that they are extremely or somewhat anxious. And every child, and even our children, aren't spared with basically reports of anxiety steadily increasing year after year. That is a broad concept to take in, but that's also on a very specific personal level for a lot of folks. And believe it or not, I must be the one in three, if I'm reading this correctly, two in every three Americans. So I must be the one, because I don't feel that anxiety. It took me years not to feel anxious over my financial situation, where I'm living paycheck to paycheck, wondering if I'm going to be able to pay the credit card bill without getting a late fee or what have you, you know, those kinds of things, to where I am today, where it's like, look, you know, they're numbers and it's no big deal and life goes on. Look, you're almost 60 years old and you survived every one of those periods of time when you thought you were going to die.
Yeah.
So talk to us about the anxiety factor. When it comes to success, it's not the fear of failure, but it is actually the fear of success that scares most people.
Yeah, I feel like I'm with you. I'm not a naturally anxious person. And I have used exercise throughout my life at periods, like for instance, when I wrote the book and the book was launching last year, and I still have young children and a job, and the second job as a charity auctioneer. And I would wake up with my stomach in knots, and I would immediately get up and go running because that would sort of even out any anxiety that I was feeling. But I definitely feel for people who are at places in their lives where anxiety is crippling them, because it's a real thing. It is a real issue that they're facing in their lives. And I do sometimes think that, you know, aside from people who are in medical need because of anxiety, the sort of person who just is living their life but is anxious because they don't have this or they don't have that, I think a lot of it is just owning your own power. And as I said, like reaching deep within to figure out what your goals are and not living life by looking around at everybody else and being like, I don't have that, and being like a dog with a bone or a dog chasing its tail, just running around and around in circles trying to figure it out. I think with clarity and with purpose, a lot of anxiety starts to reside because you feel like you know which direction you're heading in, as opposed to just sort of letting somebody else control your fate and your universe.
You've been watching my dog in my backyard. He does that a lot. I know
I have
that.
Not, I promise.
I have to say that it's a series of interesting dynamics that exist in our world today that have created the struggles. Now, in spite of the fact that the labor department claims that, you know, we're very close to full employment in the United States. I remember back in 2008 when the big downturn came. I don't know whether they're now calling it the Great Recession. And one of the first thoughts that came to me when I heard about the hundreds of thousands of people being laid off all over the country, I wonder how many of those people hated their jobs.
Interesting.
And then, if I'm not mistaken, in 2009-10, there was a new report that came out that that there was an entrepreneurial boom, and that probably most of the people who had lost their jobs said, I'm not going to do what my family, my dad, his dad, and his dad, and his dad did. I'm going to go do something I really enjoy doing. And they were sort of forced into it. You know, it's like, I got nothing to lose, so I'm going here. What about going after it before you lose it all, or before you get to that place where you have nothing to lose? Do we take the adage, don't quit your current job until you have a new one? Or are there cases where, you know what, I'm just going to go ahead and give my notice and I don't know what the future holds. I'm going to trust the universe, et cetera, et cetera. And here I go. I'm going to jump off the cliff. And as the phrase goes, jump and trust.
I am a big believer in the art of the side hustle. I think that we live in a day and age now where you don't just have to do your job. You can do your job and you can do jobs on the side. And it's becoming part of our cultural norm. So I would say I'm always a big believer in making sure you can pay the bills. You know, having three children, it's definitely something that we always think about. And, you know, I definitely think that you want to be able to sort of pull up that lifeboat next to your boat being the work that you're currently doing. And when that lifeboat gets bigger than your boat, that's when you jump ship. But I'm not a big believer in just letting it all go until you are absolutely sure that you have a net that can also support you. So dig deep. I mean, I wrote my entire book after 8 o'clock at night, after I put my kids to bed. So
find the extra dead time in your day and start working on that side hustle. Don't think you can't do two things at the same time. You absolutely can. And I believe that the passion sometimes from doing what you really love on the side can help kind of motivate you to get into your job more. And eventually, if you decide to leave it, you've left it in a good place.
Mm. Finding one's life's purpose is a big focus of this program. We talk about this all the time in terms of people finding their life's purpose. Sounds like you found yours. And I was watching some of the videos of you at these auctions, and you aren't kind. You're not anything like those auctioneers that you see down in Texas where they're auctioning off cattle and you're just rattling off numbers. Out here, 45, 45, 45, 50, 50, 55, 55. Mm-hmm. You know,
nope,
you're not doing
not
that.
Me.
Although I'd like to see you do that. I think that would be fascinating. Do I have 100,000 over here? 100,000, 150,000, 150. You know, because you're dealing in some big numbers.
Big numbers, big numbers. Yeah.
How does that make you feel when you, in a manner of speaking, you do have command and control over hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of dollars, and you're doing this for a cause. You're doing this for a particular nonprofit and so forth, and how wonderful it is that this particular organization is going to have these funds to be able to continue their fine work. But does that give you kind of a thrill of any sort that, wow, not only am I convincing these people to let go of X number of dollars, but boy, stack it all up. And, you know, I read a number where you've helped to raise, what, $4 billion overall in your thus far in your career?
No, over half a billion.
Half a billion. Bigger.
Well, I've got plenty of time left, and I intend to keep doing it. So hopefully that
40, 50 more years. I mean, hey.
No, it's so great. It's honestly, I get such a rush from being on stage in front of people and just pushing them and pushing them and pushing them to give. And, you know, I'm always motivated by the organization that I'm working on behalf of when I'm on the stage. So it never feels to me anything but great. And if I can get somebody to give a little more than they thought they were going to give when they originally raised their paddle, even better. But my whole reason for being on that stage is to help people. And it is the ultimate motivation in life. And I love it so much. And I get such a thrill from being up there. I mean, I often get off stage and I'm like giddy. I'm like high from the experience. So,
what is it? The great. Endorphins or something like that? I don't know.
Absolutely.
The biology.
It is. It's almost like going for a really long run. I finish and I get off. And actually, that's how I got myself in trouble in terms of writing the book. I had a reporter following me around from the New York Times because she was like, this is so crazy that you work in the office all day and you have these young children and you go home and you put them to bed and then you go back out late at night and take these charity auctions. And for me, I'd been doing it for so long. I mean, I started doing it when I was 24. So it always seemed like a totally normal thing for me, but I guess from the outside looking in, it looked very labor intensive and kind of odd. And so she asked me after I got off stage at 11 o'clock at night, mind you, I was pregnant with my third child, hugely pregnant and exhausted. She said, what do you do when you go home at night? How do you get off this high? And I said, well, I either read a book or I write, I'm saying this in air quotes while I'm talking to you, I write this book that I've been writing, of which I'd written exactly one chapter, and they printed it in the New York Times. And so that was actually the question that launched this entire journey for me. And it really is a question of, you know, what do you do when you're done? It's like you just keep pushing.
Yeah. When you look back at your childhood, was there anything going on there that gives you a clue that, yeah, I'm right where I'm supposed to be? Because a lot of times the things that we're doing as children at play is the very thing we should be doing as adults because it gives us so much joy.
Well, I always loved being in front of people. I always loved sort of making people laugh and have fun. And so I feel like that part of my personality is definitely something that I bring to stage. And authentically selling as myself, I think, is what makes people respond. Because I don't get up there and pretend to be, you know, someone who's 65 years old and has been an art auctioneer their whole life. I mean, I started taking auctions when I was 24. And I got on stage and I was fun and funny and would sort of talk about things that happened during the day while I was raising money. So it was sort of like a conversation rather than me just sort of saying to them, okay, this is what I need. Because I was like, I'm not selling Picassos right now. I'm literally trying to get money for a puppy on stage at 11 o'clock at night that nobody wants to buy. Like, how do I make this happen?
I like that. Now, next week are the Picassos. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
And then in October, it's the Rembrandts.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I will remind our listeners that the title of the book is The Most Powerful Woman in the Room Is You, Commanding an Audience and Selling and Sell Your Way to Success, whatever that means for you. And this is, I think, very important information that people need to get, and that is by going to Lydia Fennett, that's LYDIAFENET.com. That's the website, and we encourage you to go there. What is your personal philosophy of life and living?
My personal philosophy of life and living?
Mm-hmm.
My personal philosophy of life and living is that life is filled with opportunities, and you should just go after them with abandon. I truly believe that things only happen if you make them happen. And so in my own life and the lives of my friends, I'm constantly encouraging them to just go big.
Or as the phrase goes, go big or go home.
Or go home.
Thank you for giving us so much time here on the program as you sit there waiting for your next appointment. And should you ever find yourself in a car, in a plane, in a train, in a boat, out here on the West Coast in Central California, here in Santa Barbara, we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation.
I would love that.
And I have three final questions for you, but before I ask those, I need to remind our listeners to go to the podcast. You want to go to SoundCloud, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Spotify, Stitcher, Player FM, Blueberry, and a bunch of others. Go to richarddugan.com homepage or radio shows page, and you can listen to this and all the other podcasts that we have available from 2018 and 2019, although we do go all the way back to 2007 with our very first program, and that's also on the radio shows page. So please check them out. And if you'd like to support us, please do so through PayPal and Patreon. First of the three questions I love to ask all of my guests, you may have addressed these throughout the program, but I would like to ask these questions directly just the same. First one is, who is Lydia Fennett?
Lydia Fennett is a mom, an author, an auctioneer, and your best friend.
Oh, I like that. What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I want to continue raising money for nonprofits around the world. I want to ensure that people read my book and have confidence every day for the rest of their lives and really feel like they own their own power.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
My life's purpose is to pass back the knowledge that I gain over the years of my life to other people so that they can continue to grow and live their lives to the fullest.
Well, Lydia Fennett, I thank you again for joining us here on the program, and I do encourage people, we will be linked to your website, lydiafennett.com, and encourage people to pick up a copy of The Most Powerful Woman in the Room Is You. And today, the most powerful woman on the program is you, Lydia. Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you again, Richard. I've had a wonderful time.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.